In the twilight of 1868, a nervous 24-year-old Friedrich Nietzsche found himself frantically battling with a tailor's assistant over payment for a new suit, even as he was due to meet the great composer Richard Wagner for the first time. Despite rain and sartorial crisis, Nietzsche made it to the Brockhaus's drawing room, where Wagner played parts of Die Meistersinger, spoke passionately about Schopenhauer, and read from his autobiography. The evening ended with Wagner warmly inviting the young scholar to make music and talk philosophy. For Nietzsche, who had discovered Wagner's music in his school days, this encounter left him in a state of indescribable elation. Little did he know, this meeting would begin a relationship that would profoundly shape and eventually nearly destroy his intellectual journey. Today, Nietzsche's ideas permeate modern thought, with figures from Freud to Foucault acknowledging his influence. His concepts like the death of God, will to power, and eternal recurrence have transcended philosophy to become cultural touchstones, while his declaration that God is dead remains perhaps the most famous philosophical statement ever made. Born in 1844 in the small village of Rocken, Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche grew up under the shadow of death. His father, a Lutheran pastor, died from brain softening when Friedrich was only 4 years old. This early loss would haunt Nietzsche throughout his life, particularly as his own health deteriorated in adulthood. Growing up in a household of women, his mother, sister, grandmother, and two aunts, young Friedrich developed an unusual sense of importance, walking 5 paces ahead of his mother and sister to shield them from perils and monsters. At the Dom Gymnasium, Nietzsche showed remarkable intellectual promise, excelling in subjects that captivated him while showing little interest in mathematics. His spare time overflowed with creative pursuits. He began a novel entitled Death and Destruction, composed numerous musical pieces, wrote dozens of poems, and took fencing lessons despite his unsuitable physical constitution. At 14, he displayed remarkable self-awareness, critically analyzing his own juvenile poetry and predicting the development of symbolist poetry, warning against ornate and striking language that degenerates into sententious obscurity. Music became central to his development when his mother bought him a piano. Through his friend Gustav Krug's father's connections, young Nietzsche was exposed to romantic music, with Beethoven becoming his first musical hero. At 9, he composed an oratorio inspired by Handel's Hallelujah Chorus, expressing the passionate religious devotion that permeated his household. Yet even as a child, Nietzsche harbored extraordinary heretical thoughts. While outwardly professing devotion to God, privately he had begun philosophizing about a different Holy Trinity, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Devil, reasoning that God, to think himself, had to create his opposite. This early theological questioning foreshadowed his later philosophical challenges to Christianity and conventional morality. At 14, Nietzsche entered Schulpforte, a former Cistercian monastery surrounded by 12-foot walls that functioned as Germany's most rigorous classical school. Founded on humanist educational principles and later modified by Wilhelm von Humboldt, the school emphasized classical languages, philology, and the Humboldtian ideals of Wissenschaft, knowledge as dynamic process, and Bildung, spiritual growth through learning. The daily routine was brutally structured, beginning at 4 a.m. with the unlocking of dormitory doors and ending at 9 p.m. with bedtime, filled with 15 hours of study and lessons. Madame de Stael called it the most rigorous school day in Europe. Students spoke Latin and Greek, studied ancient literature and philosophy, and had minimal contact with the outside world. Initially overwhelmed with homesickness, Nietzsche eventually excelled academically despite struggling with Hebrew and mathematics. Though awkward and unathletic, he found devoted friends and continued his passion for music, impressing classmates with his piano improvisations. His religious devotion remained strong through confirmation, but he began critically examining Christian texts, writing essays on fate and free will that questioned religious assumptions. At 17, Nietzsche was already exploring profound philosophical questions about free will, fate, Christianity, and human evolution. His essay, Fate and History, questioned whether humanity was merely a stage in universal development, anticipating Darwinian thinking. He was drawn to controversial thinkers who would shape his future philosophy: Emerson, Empedocles, and Friedrich Hölderlin. Despite receiving a low grade for his essay on Hölderlin and being advised to stick to poets who are healthier, more lucid, and more German, Nietzsche persisted in his admiration for the neglected poet, appreciating his critique of German Philistinism and nationalism. Throughout his time at Porta, Nietzsche suffered from debilitating health problems, blinding headaches, ear infections, stomach ailments, and extreme sensitivity to light. The school treated him with leeches on his earlobes and neck, remedies he found useless. Despite 20 recorded illness episodes averaging a week each and doctors predicting eventual blindness, Nietzsche maintained extraordinary productivity, demonstrating his relentless intellectual drive despite physical limitations. After a brief, unfulfilling year at the University of Bonn, where he joined a fraternity only to be disappointed by its focus on drinking rather than intellectual discourse, Nietzsche followed his mentor, Professor Ritschl, to Leipzig University. There, he flourished intellectually, founding the Classical Society and transforming a local cafe into a philological stock exchange. His gift for bringing dry subjects to life made his Latin papers on obscure classical topics surprisingly popular. At Leipzig, Nietzsche challenged accepted ideas about Homer, arguing the Odyssey and Iliad must have been created by a single genius rather than multiple folk poets. His work on the Greek poet Theognis earned Ritschl's praise, and he won a prize for an essay on Diogenes Laertius, which he headed with Pindar's line he would cherish lifelong: "Become what you are, having learned what that is." This intellectual flourishing was interrupted when he was conscripted into the Prussian artillery in 1867. Despite limited riding experience, he trained with horses and cannons, often muttering, "Schopenhauer, help," while struggling beneath his mount. A severe chest injury occurred when he misjudged mounting his horse, resulting in a suppurating wound that required months of treatment, including morphine and silver nitrate. At 24, Nietzsche received an astonishing offer, the chair of philology at Basel University. Still a student with only 4 terms of university study and no degree, he was recommended by Ritschl, who praised his brilliance. Leipzig awarded him a doctorate without examination, and in April 1869, he was appointed professor of classical philology with a stipend of 3,000 francs. In Basel, Nietzsche found himself caught between 2 powerful intellectual influences, Richard Wagner and Jakob Burckhardt. While Wagner offered extravagant novelties and dramatic personality, Burckhardt represented a more restrained, scholarly approach. The two men embodied opposing worldviews. Wagner admired Bismarck and German nationalism, while Burckhardt was devoted to Europeanism and saw Jewish culture as a universal leavening of European bread. Nietzsche's relationship with Wagner deepened when he began visiting the composer at Villa Tripschen on Lake Lucerne. Their shared interest in Schopenhauer's philosophy bound them together. For Nietzsche, increasingly unable to accept Christianity, Schopenhauer provided a viable alternative to the dominant Kantian philosophy. Schopenhauer's view that all life is suffering resonated deeply with Nietzsche, whose chronic ill health kept him in constant pain. The Wagners gave Nietzsche his own upstairs study at Tripschen, christened the Denkstube, the thinking room. Nietzsche found profound inspiration listening to Wagner working on the 3rd act of Siegfried, hearing the master's footsteps pacing, his raspy voice singing snatches, followed by silences as he tried notes on the piano or wrote them down. During daytime breaks, Cosima and Nietzsche would picnic in the woods with the children, watching what they privately called the star dance of sunlight on the lake. When Nietzsche and Wagner climbed mountains together, they discussed music in Greek drama, ideas that would form Nietzsche's first book, The Birth of Tragedy from the Spirit of Music. Their relationship was not without tensions, however. Wagner had begun writing The Ring as a fiery revolutionary in his mid-30s, completing it only at 61, when internationally revered. Its revolutionary spirit never wavered from its 1848 birth during the Year of Revolutions, when Wagner had manned the barricades in Dresden before fleeing to Switzerland disguised in women's clothing. Christmas 1869 marked a special moment for Nietzsche as the only guest at Tribschen. Wagner and Cosima observed elaborate Christmas rituals despite their religious differences. She a devoted Catholic, he a confirmed atheist. Together they enchanted the children with German traditions. The following week brought extraordinary closeness between Nietzsche and Cosima, whose diary remained blank after December 26, resuming only on January 3 with the note that she'd spent most time with Professor Nietzsche. Nietzsche's first book emerged from both a passionate attack on cultural degeneration and a manifesto for German cultural regeneration through Wagner's vision. Yet it endures as a revolutionary perception of the transactions between rational and instinctive, between life and art, between culture and human response. The book's famous opening declares that art's development depends on the duality of the Apollonian and Dionysian principles, engaged in continual struggle with occasional reconciliation. The Apollonian represents the plastic arts, sculpture, painting, architecture, and dreams, embodying the describable, the rational, the moral individual. Dionysus governs music and tragedy, arts that transcend boundaries and subvert normal identity. As god of wine, intoxication, ritual madness, and theatrical illusion, Dionysus enables self-oblivion and mystical transcendence. The genius of Greek tragedy lay in coupling the Apollonian and Dionysian through the chorus. Nietzsche argues that Greek tragedy died with Socratic maxims: virtue is knowledge, sins arise from ignorance, and the virtuous man is happy. This optimistic, rational formula extinguished tragedy. Post-Socratic plays required dialectical heroes and visible connections between virtue and knowledge, reducing Aeschylus's transcendental justice to flat and impudent poetic justice. Nietzsche questions whether our flight into science might be fear-driven escape from pessimism, a subtle last resort against truth, or a sort of cowardice and falsity. With culture enfeebled, he warns that when the disaster slumbering in the womb of theoretical culture begins to frighten modern man, salvation will only come through a return to the Dionysian spirit. Who holds the key to this salvation? Schopenhauer and Wagner. Opera, with its marriage of words and music, presents the new tragic art form reuniting the Dionysian and Apollonian. Wagner's music revives tragic myth, German rather than Greek, and employs dissonance that reflects the tension in man's soul. Despite praise from Liszt and various aristocrats, the professional silence surrounding the birth of tragedy was deafening. No reviews appeared from philosophers or philologists, making Nietzsche feel almost as though I had committed a crime. The book would eventually become one of Nietzsche's bestsellers, but of the initial 800 copies printed in 1872, only 625 sold over the next 6 years. The inaugural Bayreuth Festival of 1876 proved to be everything Nietzsche had feared it would become. Arriving on July 22nd, he found himself a mere professor with low status among the 5,000 daily visitors flowing through Wanfried. The festival had transformed from Wagner's original vision of a new Aeschylean revival of tragic spirit into a society event for the entire loafing riffraff of Europe. Nietzsche was repulsed by the presence of anti-Semites, finding gratification in The Ring's crude racial struggle, and by the aristocratic pageantry. Nietzsche suffered in cheap, stifling lodgings in the center of town, surrounded by the unbearable tumult of thousands cramming the baking streets. Food was nearly impossible to obtain, as Tchaikovsky noted. Throughout the whole duration of the festival, food forms the chief interest of the public. The artistic representations take a secondary place. Unable to watch from the bright auditorium, Nietzsche was given a dark, stifling cupboard-like room near the stage, where the unprecedented volume of the 100-piece orchestra drove him to escape. Salvation appeared for Nietzsche in the figure of Malwida von Meissenbach, a wealthy, aging anarchist who had been exiled following the rebellions of 1848-9. Seeing Nietzsche's physical distress, she offered him daily refuge in her cool garden, unlimited sympathy, and a soothing diet of milk. He took long swims in the little river flowing through her garden, a regime that revived even his appreciation for Wagner's music, if not the Bayreuth spectacle. On August 3rd or 4th, Nietzsche fled Bayreuth without telling anyone, taking the train to Klingenbrunn in the Bavarian forest. He returned for the opening night on August 13th to meet his sister, Rode, and von Gersdorf, who had all paid considerable sums for tickets and accommodations. At Bayreuth, all three friends were struck by romantic passions as if under Wagner's operatic love potion. After the Bayreuth festival, the university granted Nietzsche a year's leave of absence with pay, freeing him completely from teaching duties. Malwida von Meissenbach invited him to spend the winter in Sorrento, which he accepted. Though his publisher pressed him for the next untimely meditation, Nietzsche had a different work forming in his mind, provisionally titled The Plowshare, Die Pflugschar, intended to cut away the choking weeds of his former idols, Wagner and Schopenhauer. Nietzsche's return to Switzerland from Italy brought little improvement to his health and no completed book, despite the intellectually stimulating time at Villa Rubinacci. With his untimely meditations failing to either revitalize German culture or sell well, he suggested to his publisher they consider the series finished. He had moved on to a new work that began during his brief respite from Bayreuth at Klingenbrunn. The project evolved from working titles like The Plowshare and The Free Spirit into Human, All Too Human, subtitled A Book for Free Spirits. Described as a monument to a crisis, this work examined the human condition with reason as its guiding principle. Written in personal, lucid, and elegant language, it marked Nietzsche's transition from philologist and cultural commentator to polemicist. The book represented a clean break from nostalgic glorification of ancient Greece, Schopenhauer, Wagner, and the division of the world into will and representation. It was written not for philosophers, but for inquiring minds willing to examine cultural, social, political, and philosophical questions free from preconceptions. Nietzsche boldly dedicated the book to Voltaire, a deliberate act of defiance against Wagner. Human, All Too Human was organized into sections covering fundamental questions, moral sensations, religious life, art, culture, society, gender, politics, and the individual. Each section consisted of numbered aphorisms or aphoristic paragraphs. Nietzsche argues that philosophers merely make statements about humanity observed over a very limited time span, failing to recognize that man has evolved and continues to evolve. He challenges the assumption that instincts in present-day humans represent unchangeable facts of human nature. Religious, moral, and aesthetic sensibilities belong only to the surface of things, though humans prefer to believe they touch the heart of the world because they give meaning to life. This leads to self-deception, what he calls the astrological delusion, believing the universe revolves around human fate. Nietzsche describes the free spirit as one who applies analytical and critical interpretation to religion, science, and the ideal. Though such spirits do not yet exist, he envisions them emerging from the future's mist, wanderers who know themselves as travelers to a final destination that does not exist. Rather than being disheartened by this, they find liberation in uncertainty and transience, welcoming the mysteries of every new dawn for the evolution of thought that it will bring. Nietzsche sold most possessions except books and pictures, entrusting his finances to Franz Overbeck and his notebooks to Elizabeth. Carrying only two trunks of essential books, he began wandering through alpine resorts, Davos, Grindelwald, Interlaken, and others. He walked 8 to 10 hours daily, contemplating the immense realm of the imperfectly understood, while avoiding the highest elevations where bright snow light pained his sensitive eyes. During this period, Nietzsche described himself as a subterranean man who tunnels and mines and undermines, working cautiously in darkness but driven by faith toward his own daybreak and redemption. This solitary, mole-like existence transformed the former philologist into a visionary with prophetic horizons. Nietzsche believed himself peculiarly susceptible to electricity, especially during storms. Since his Forte days, contemporaries had noticed his creative inspiration during thunderstorms. Now, he claimed, 80% of my suffering results from these influences, experiencing three-day attacks of pain, vomiting, partial paralysis, and speech difficulties. Yet, in the thin mountain air, he also experienced moments of exquisite intensity and happiness, feeling himself thinned and etiolated. He preferred forests that could hide him from the all-seeing sky. Despite his publisher warning that the market for telegraphic aphorisms was saturated, Nietzsche filled 12 pocket notebooks with what he called his accursed telegram style, the only way he could record thoughts between headaches. He sent Schmeitzner 2 collections of aphorisms as appendices to Human All Too Human, A Miscellany of Opinions and Maxims, and The Wanderer and His Shadow. He also completed Daybreak, a new book of 575 aphorisms subtitled Thoughts on the Prejudices of Morality, covering topics from dog padding to Wagner, free will, religion, and the state. Looking back on 1879, Nietzsche counted 118 days of acute and disabling sickness. Despite his meager achievements, a few minor writings, a failed professorship, 2 books with minimal impact, he embraced spiritual isolation, seeking no human company. His illness became his Alexandrian journey, with each painful seizure testing his resilience and each recovery confirming the value of suffering as the price of revelation. In February 1882, Paul Rhee arrived in Jona, bearing the Malling Hansen writing ball, a brass hedgehog-like typewriter that proved as delicate as a small dog and causes a lot of trouble. In March, Rhee departed for Rome to rejoin Malwida von Meissenbug's Roman Club. There, he encountered the magnetic Lou Salome, a cosmopolitan 21-year-old Russian of startling intelligence who had come south from Zurich for her health. This intellectual femme fatale, who would later bewitch Rilke and Freud, had Rhee and Malwida pronouncing Nietzsche's name as that of a god. Lou had already envisioned a Heilige Dreieinheit, Holy Trinity, of philosophizing free spirits with Rhee and Nietzsche before they'd even met. She dreamed of a pleasant study filled with books and flowers, flanked by 2 bedrooms, where they would work together in joyful and earnest bond. Their meeting in St. Peter's so overpowered Nietzsche that he retired to bed at Malwida's villa, where Rhee and Lou visited him. He read to them from his work in progress, The Gay Science, an effervescent outpouring of his jubilant mood as he stood on the brink of impending adventure. Though Lou hadn't read any of his books, her intensity, intelligence, and seriousness deeply impressed him. Lou became fascinated by Nietzsche, seeing him as one who wore his mask awkwardly, a god from the wilderness who had put on a suit to pass among men. She interpreted his mask as placatory, springing from goodness and pity toward others. She quoted his aphorism, "People who think deeply feel themselves to be comedians in their relationship with others because they first have to simulate a surface in order to be understood." Nietzsche took their triune cohabitation seriously, impishly renaming it the Unholy Trinity. Still, he felt obligated to protect Lou's reputation by extending a proposal of marriage through Rhee, a curious commission as he himself had already proposed and was falling deeper in love. Lou declined, explaining she was disinclined to marriage on principle and would lose her pension as a Russian nobleman's daughter. As Rome grew humid, Nietzsche decided to leave for the North Italian Alps with Rhee. Lou arranged to join them. On May 5th, they reunited in Orta, where the following day, Lu and Nietzsche slipped away to ascend Monte Sacro, an experience Nietzsche would describe as the most exquisite of his life. In November 1882, Nietzsche left for Genoa, speaking grandly of metaphorical voyages to the terra incognita of the human interior. His health deteriorated terribly that winter as he consumed massive doses of opium, attempting to dull the emotional agony of Lu's rejection. He wrote attention-seeking letters mentioning suicide, confessing, "The barrel of a revolver is for me now a source of relatively pleasant thoughts." Finding his preferred boarding house full, he settled in a tiny albergo in Rapallo, reimagining it as an island of the Greek archipelago that had drifted toward the mainland. "I have never lived in such genuine Robinson Crusoe insularity and oblivion," he wrote, though complaining about the awful cuisine. At Christmas, he severed ties with his mother and Elizabeth, instructing friends to withhold his address from family. Yet, on Christmas Day, he wrote hopefully to Overbeck about discovering the alchemical trick of turning this muck into gold. This alchemical transformation produced Thus Spoke Zarathustra, an ecstatic, prophetic, spiritual odyssey through the modern moral world. The ancient Persian prophet Zarathustra descends from the mountain after God's death to show how morality might exist in a post-deist world through honesty, consistency, and courage. The book continues where the gay science ended, with Incipit Tragoedia, where Zarathustra first appeared, descending after 10 years of mountain solitude to share his overflowing wisdom. Nietzsche chose Zarathustra deliberately. This Persian prophet declared ancient Persian gods were evil. His cosmology offered a solution to the problem of evil through the battle between Ahura Mazda, good, and Angra-Menu, evil. After his mountain solitude, Zarathustra descends to be among the people, carrying transformative fire. When his first disciple attempts to cross the abyss by walking a tightrope, a buffoon topples him to his death. Despite mockery, Zarathustra resolves to show them the rainbow bridge to becoming the Superman through 18 mystical beatitudes, including, "I love those who do not know how to live except by going under, for they are those who cross over." Nietzsche sent this fifth gospel to his publisher on February 14, 1883, learning of Wagner's death the same day, a supernatural connection. "My father Wagner was dead, my son Zarathustra was born." Despite Wagner's betrayal, he had exchanged letters with Nietzsche's doctors suggesting his changed thinking came from unnatural excesses. Nietzsche could now reclaim his purer self. For 2 years, Nietzsche descended deeper into himself while wandering Europe's beautiful landscapes, living in cheap lodgings as a quiet, courteous, increasingly shabby presence, easily ignored by fellow guests. Despite adhering to meager, idiosyncratic diets, hoping to spare himself intestinal blitzkriegs, nothing defended him from relentless episodes of vomiting, cramps, searing temple pain, and week-long bouts of diarrhea. Though outwardly quiet, Nietzsche was taking a hammer to our moral and intellectual traditions in his mature philosophy. With Zarathustra's affirmative cry unheard, he published Beyond Good and Evil, 1886, at his own expense, followed by On the Genealogy of Morality, 1887, both clarifying his philosophy while opposing society's moral apathy in clinging to Judeo-Christian morality without believing in the religion itself. In Beyond Good and Evil, Nietzsche set out to explore the dangerous perhaps by critiquing the foundations of modernity itself. "Supposing that truth is a woman," he began arrestingly, questioning all dogmatic philosophers who have never understood either. "What we take for truth, those lofty edifices of European thinking, rest on cornerstones of folk superstition and limited human experiences. Yet man cannot live without such untruths, having bricked himself into beliefs and enslaved himself to priests, astrologers, and philosophers." In On the Genealogy of Morality, Nietzsche excavated the roots of morality itself. How did we willingly adopt Judeo-Christian values that turned us into obedient cattle? The slaves, powerless but lusting after power, were consumed by ressentiment, a neurosis beyond mere resentment that led them to invert values, glorifying their own miserable condition while demonizing sensuality and power. The antidote to slave morality is the Übermensch, the free, affirmative spirit driven by will to power. This force exists throughout organic life, in tree roots pulverizing bedrock, expanding ice cracking cliffs, and moss spores collapsing palace roofs. It represents both self-mastery and the emotion of command. The higher man who has mastered himself can withstand uncertainty, dancing to the music of what if with the courage to live without outdated certainties. It is true that there is no such thing as truth, perhaps. In winter 1887-8, Nietzsche returned to Nice, where the Pension de Genève had been redecorated after the earthquake. He was childishly delighted to choose the wallpaper for his room, a reddish-brown striped and speckled pattern. They had given him a chaise longue in addition to the bed. He knew they charged their dear, half-blind professor only 5.5 francs daily, while other guests paid between 8 and 10. The cold, rainy Nice winter left Nietzsche blue-fingered until Gast sent a warm dressing gown and Franziska sent a small stove, his fire idol, around which he danced to restore circulation. He published his only musical score, Hymn to Life, based on Lou Salome's poem, though no conductor would perform it. Encouraged by J.V. Widman's review describing Beyond Good and Evil as dynamite, Nietzsche sent out 66 complimentary copies, vastly more than his previous secretive distribution of Zarathustra. The most significant response came from George Brandes, Northern Europe's foremost literary critic who championed dangerous free spirits like Kierkegaard, Ibsen, and Dostoevsky. After receiving On the Genealogy of Morality, Brandes wrote enthusiastically to Nietzsche, praising his aristocratic radicalism. Nietzsche responded excitedly, sending Brandes all his writings and revealing his isolation with Ovid's words, "He lived well who hid well." Brandes delivered 2 lectures on Friedrich Nietzsche, a discussion of aristocratic radicalism, at Copenhagen University in April 1888, drawing over 300 attendees. On September 20th, Nietzsche left for Turin. Despite flooding near Como that required crossing a wooden bridge by torchlight, conditions that would normally have triggered days of illness, he felt liberated by the water's power. Turin once again worked its magic, but more powerfully than before. Pacing its arcades and riverbanks, he experienced the intoxicating sensation of having reached the affirmative spiritual state of the Übermensch. The present moment contained all, and it was glorious. I am now the most grateful man in the world. It is my great harvest time. Everything has become easy for me. Nietzsche spent his days working furiously on the Antichrist, subtitled A Curse on Christianity, a short vitriolic work that hurled abuse at Christianity while preserving respect for Jesus himself. He revisited many ideas from Twilight of the Idols and On the Genealogy of Morality, Christianity's dishonesty in devaluing earthly life, the priest's use of ressentiment to create slave mentality, religion's hatred of nature and reality. On October 15th, his 44th birthday, Nietzsche began his autobiography, Ecce Homo. Taking the title from Pilate's words when presenting Christ for judgment, he continued setting himself up in competition with Christ, another living God condemned to death by neglect. The book's chapter titles were deliberately provocative. Why I am so wise? Why I am so clever? Why I write such good books? Why I am a destiny? Throughout, Nietzsche mixed bombast and trickery, exaggeration and manic self-celebration with facts and interpretations. The final section, Why I Am a Destiny, opened with his declaration, "I know my fate. One day there will be associated with my name the recollection of something frightful. I am not a man. I am dynamite." The book ended with, "Have I been understood? Dionysus versus the Crucified," followed by an ellipse. In January 1889, Nietzsche's final breakdown occurred in Turin. After witnessing a cabbie beating his horse, he rushed to embrace the animal before collapsing in tears. In the following days, he descended into madness, singing, raving, and playing violently on the piano. He engaged in erratic behavior, including naked dancing and delusional episodes. His friend Franz Overbeck found him in a pitiful state, pretending to read while cowering on this sofa. After consulting with Dr. Willa, Overbeck arranged Nietzsche's transport to Basel Psychiatric Clinic, where he was diagnosed with progressive paralysis, likely from late-stage syphilis. Though his mother Franziska wanted to care for him, his violent and unpredictable behavior necessitated professional care. He was transferred to the Jena Clinic, where he exhibited various delusions, claiming to be royalty, believing Cosima Wagner was his wife, and experiencing paranoid episodes. He engaged in disturbing behaviors, from sleeping on the floor to acts of self-harm. By February 1890, his condition stabilized enough for daily outings with his mother. However, his deterioration continued, and he was eventually confined to two rooms and a veranda in Naumburg, hidden from public view behind overgrown plants. After suffering strokes in 1898 and 1899, Nietzsche died on August 25, 1900. His sister Elizabeth inherited his estate and took control of his legacy through the Nietzsche Archive. She fundamentally misunderstood his philosophy, his rejection of systems, embrace of uncertainty, and belief that life could be meaningful without divine ideals. In 1901, she published The Will to Power, compiled from his private notes, later expanding it significantly and shaping his posthumous reputation to align with her own beliefs. Nietzsche had predicted his name would be associated with something frightful, a profound crisis of conscience challenging everything previously believed. This wasn't a wish to spread evil, but rather a declaration of his role in confronting the implications of God's death and opening new philosophical horizons. His sister's control of his work lasted twice as long as his writing career, allowing her to weave his words into her own agenda and distort his legacy.